of injury from falls. It'll be presented by Dr. Fisher, who's a board certified in occupational and environmental medicine and currently practices at University of Western States in Portland, Oregon. She's earned her medical degree followed by a residency in internal medicine at the University of Utah. With a desire to focus on preventative medicine, she completed a master's of public health and a fellowship in occupational environmental medicine at the University of Washington in Seattle in 2010. Please welcome Dr. Rachel Fisher.
Hi, good afternoon. So I'm not a researcher. I'm the first non-researcher. How many of you treat patients? Anyone else? Okay, good. So my talk's going to be a little bit more focused on treatment after the fall. So I have no disclosures. So I'm going to start with a clinical case. And Dr. Sudong and I did not collaborate with her, but this was he fits the perfect demographic of the group that she talked about that tend to have a larger risk for falls. This was a gentleman, 22-year-old, Spanish-speaking male roofer, and it was residential roofing. So he fell from a one-story building onto concrete. He landed on a left outstretched arm and then on his face. He suffered multiple fractures. He had a complex fracture of his wrist. He had multiple fractures in his hand, the third through fifth metacarpals. He had a left zygomatic fracture, and I just included this x-ray here to kind of show you where the zygomatic bone is for those of you who are curious. He had three tooth fractures, a concussion but without loss of consciousness, and then he had multiple strains and sprains specifically to the cervical, thoracic, and the lumbar spine. And it's noted that he was previously healthy. So what exactly is tertiary prevention when you're talking about falling? Well, I think about it in two different ways, and maybe this could be argued. But one is, if a fall does occur, how do we reduce the severity of that injury? So I kind of make it analogous to highway safety, right? And if we're in a car accident, how do we prevent the degree of the injury in the driver? So we engineer our airbags, the design of the car and the roads and so forth. And in falling, we think about things like being able to grab a railing, and also these personal fall arrest systems. And then the other way to think about tertiary prevention, I think, is, okay, once the fall occurs, how, and workers specifically, how do we rehabilitate that worker to optimal health, to get them back to work in a timely way so they don't spend a lot of time on disability, and really reduce the risk of re-injury in the future. So I have no endorsements for Gravitech. I just like their slide. But it just shows here these different tertiary symptoms, and then specifically looking at this type of system and then this fall arrest system that has, you know, a harness, it has this lifeline, and usually it has some kind of deceleration device on it. But I'm not really going to talk about this. This is not my area of expertise. What I'm going to talk about more is the clinical side of it. So I think it's interesting to know, and I actually didn't really know this until I started looking at the research. I mean, as a clinician, I see probably in my clinic, I would see, gosh, five or six falls a week. And most of them are ground level and not this serious, but I picked this case because I think it demonstrates exactly how complex a fall injury can be. And I wanted to put a face to what this actually means for our workers. And so we've already talked about sort of the statistics around falls and construction, and I thought this was interesting as well, that it's the number one reason for OSHA citations. That was in 2014, and I think people that work, as Dr. Sudong mentioned, in these smaller businesses that are not going to be inspected by OSHA, I think those workers are at much greater risk, such as my patient. And these are the areas where most of the injuries occur, lower extremity, and this is for ground level falls. Trunk, and then multiple is 22%, upper extremity less so, and so forth. So back to the clinical case. So this particular gentleman, by the time he came to my clinic, I can do minor urgent care, but certainly he went to the emergency department and was evaluated from head to toe for his injuries. So by the time he got into my clinic for follow-up, we have a nice system in Portland with our workers' comp system, so they made sure he went to occupational medicine for follow-up. He had already had an open reduction and internal fixation of his wrist. and his hand and his zygomatic fracture. So he was still under the care of his orthopedic physician, but the surgery had been done. He was out of a cast. He was in a wrist brace. He had not yet started any type of therapy. He was on time loss. So in other words, he was not working. He was just trying to recover from his injuries. He had not received any treatment for his dental injuries. When he presented to me, you know, my main thinking was, and maybe this is how you feel as well when you get a patient who comes in with multiple injuries, is where do I start? You know, what do I need to do for this individual? And he was very fearful of losing his job. Of course, he wasn't familiar with the workers' comp system in the United States or in the state of Oregon, and he was afraid of losing his job. He was also experiencing quite a bit of pain. He reported feeling very stressed and depressed. He was having difficulties at the time with sleep, memory, and also mood swings. And that kind of came out later in my treatment of him. Overall, though, I mean, he was ambulating well. He had more increased pain with sitting because of his spinal injuries, his strains and sprains. But my goal for him was, okay, how can I at least get him up and moving and feeling productive? Because I think that will help with the mood. It will certainly also help with his rehab. So a couple things to think about. So these were kind of, I would say, how I grouped my thinking in consideration for full release. And I think, again, it's really important that we put a face and a picture of what these fall injuries look like. So I started a comprehensive physical rehabilitation program for him with the end goal of getting him into like a work hardening or a work conditioning. Because any time a worker is going to be out for an extended period of time, they do get deconditioned, especially if they have a physical job like roofing. So I got him into intensive PT and occupational therapy. He was also referred to a chiropractor for care. And then ultimately the goal was going to be work conditioning with work hardening, which unfortunately this gentleman did not do. So the next thing I had to do is keep really good communications with consultations in orthopedic and the plastic surgeon, referral to dental for his dental fractures, make sure those were repaired. About 6 months into my treatment for him, or it was after the injury, his stress and depression was actually worsening, and he was having a lot of memory and mood issues. So the other thing I did was made a referral for neuropsychiatric testing, which is, of course, was very complicated by the fact that this was a Spanish-speaking gentleman. We weren't sure how that was going to translate to see how accurate the results would be for or how valid they would be with neuropsychiatric testing. But it was important also from a workers' comp perspective because it had to be documented in order for him to make sure he had appropriate compensation at the end, to make sure he got appropriate rehabilitation for however long it took. And then finally, I had to make sure I kept on top of the communication with the work comp insurer and the employer. I really wanted him to get back to work even part-time doing something where he wasn't on the roof, but where he could be on the ground doing cleanup or things like that to get him using his hands. So that can be an issue for a lot of reasons. One, if I, the physician, I'm sure you've experienced this in work comp cases, you believe this patient needs continued care and work comp is saying, it's been 6 months, they should be good now, they should go. And you're like, no. So there's that constant, you know, having to provide documentation and evidence that they need continued care. The other job, especially with these complicated cases, is setting up the expectation for everyone involved of whether or not this worker can actually return to the job of injury. Because many times, especially with these serious falls, they can't. They have to be retrained, go into vocational rehab, perhaps, and get training to be able to do something else for a living. And that's a very scary place to be. So these are the final challenges. So the rehab efforts, again, that's trying to make sure that you're able to demonstrate to the payers that this person needs continued care. The duration of time loss and recovery has multiple considerations. So that's the adequacy of treatment, and that may be because treatment may be cut off early. Health status is huge at the time of injury. We've talked about that. So that could be cognitive function. It could also be if this person is diabetic. Diabetic's not going to heal as quickly. It could also be if the person's obese or has cardiovascular disease. Those individuals are, by nature, going to take longer to recover from this type of injury. And that must be considered when we're thinking about a healthy population. And I think about the workers I see on a regular basis and trying to help them understand that, okay, if they, even if they haven't fallen, that your health is important, because if something like this were to happen, you need to be able to bounce back. You need that resiliency to recover. And then also the challenges having to do with communication, as I mentioned, with the employer, and availability of work accommodation, the nature of the work and whether it's something they can return to or not. And then I think some really important aspects that often get missed are perceived disability by the patient. And this patient had a lot of perceived disability. Coping mechanisms, what is their social support system like? This individual was relatively new to the United States, didn't have a large network. I encouraged him to get involved in his church and other things to help get help for him. And then their expectation and outlook goes along with that. All of these factors have to be considered. And I think tertiary prevention is tough, and it really points to the fact that we have to focus on primary prevention. I mean, that really is the key. Because once these happen, especially these more serious injuries, they can take a long time to recover. So that's it. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. We've had a very nice series of presentations, from epidemiology to primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention of injuries. We're going to have a moderated discussion now. I'll ask a question, and each person will have a chance to discuss, to answer the question, and then we'll take questions from the audience. So we'd like to explore how we can be more effective in translating research into policy and practice. So I'd like you to address the issue of what are the gaps in research and the literature in your area. I think another way of looking at that are what are the trends in research, or where do you think things are headed? And you can also at the same time address the issue of what can we do to better translate research into practice. So you can emphasize one or the other. Okay, so Dr. Varma, and please speak up.
So for me, as I said in my presentation, is that a lot of researchers focus on falls among older adults, and sometimes we even focus on elderly people. And what we are missing out is younger adults and middle-aged adults. And if we can get them, then we can prevent falls in older adults too. And when I talk to people, generally people come up with this question that yes, there are a lot of injuries happening to young and middle-aged adults, but look at the severe injuries, right? So elderly people are having much more severe injuries. And that is true, is that the injuries among elderly are very severe. But on the other side is that if you look at, let's look at income, right? So your income peaks when you are in middle age. So if somebody gets injured and loses their income, that's when they are most productive. And it has implication not only for them, but also for the family and the society. So we should not only look at that, but also look at the middle-aged adults, and particularly in the occupational setting. So falls from heights is very severe injury, and a lot of falls are also happening at the same level. We do look at falls in restaurant workers. Now, restaurant workers, there are a lot of young workers work in restaurants. And if you work in a restaurant, you are surrounded by so much like hot stuff around you. So you can put your hand in a oil that's burning at, like, I don't know, 300 degrees Celsius, so you can fry your hand. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done in the occupational setting and in general population. And the other thing I think is that we can do more research in the built environment to reduce falls.
Thank you very much. Dr. Sudan?
So if you want to ask me the gap in research, I may have a lot to tell you. But my research area is surveillance. So I'm not an expert in intervention, even I included some information on intervention. In terms of surveillance, for example, the data source, we always want to know where the data. For example, the National Health Interview Survey, you use that, you only got the numbers for overall falls. However, how many of those falls I work very late. Can you get that? I don't. So I know all of those data very well. So that's why you did not include that part in your presentation, even you know this session we talk about work-related issues. So is the data I showed you based on the BIS, the major data source in the United States, work-related injuries and illnesses, the fatal injuries from the BIS, the sensor for fatal occupational injuries. The non-fatal is based on the survey of occupational injury and illness. Both of these are annual data. So even we already have a good data system, but some information that's very important for health intervention and protections is not there. For example, we have so many methods of for intervention. We have toolbox, we have tools and the methods. Which one is the most effective? How people use workers use them on worker class? We don't have good data. We developed the database using the NASH phase report. Some of you may not know that NASH supported some state level data collection. They investigated fatal injuries in very detail. We developed the database because the original was the text reports. We wanted to do the further analysis using some statistical packages. We have to get the data, develop the database of our own. Based on our initial findings, we found we collected data since the program started from 1982 to the most data in 2014. Of the more than 320 fatal falls in the construction industry, we found only 5% of the fatal falls or the decedents were fall protections when the injury occurred. I think the problem was so small. And even the 5% definitely either the fall protection failed or whatever, something wrong that did not fully protect the workers. However, based on data we found, more than half of the fatal injuries caused by falls. All the victims did not have access to fall protection. Did not have access, more than half. So this the investigation that they provide a very detailed information. So I think that's the problem. Even those numbers may not represent the current situation. I'm talking about the construction industry. You know, construction in terms of work-related fall injuries is the number one. The most problems are in the construction industry. Even the numbers may not represent the current situation in the construction industry, but at least the numbers show the fall prevention in construction is not or far less enough. Mm-hmm. And we don't have good data to know what the current situation at the workplace. That, I think, that major gap in my research area.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sudong. And Dr. Smith, right?
So the question was, what can we do to enhance translating research practice? I think there are several things that I would like to talk about very briefly, but the first is finding the community partners. This is a forum around workplace injuries. I think that the next step would be to bring programs such as the cognitive training intervention that I use into a workplace and find a way to test this intervention in a real world workplace setting. That said, my two trials that I ran weren't necessarily targeted towards older workers per se, but I mean, that's something that I do try to do with all of my studies, is just use a more pragmatic design, which means essentially getting loosening some of the internal controls of the research, and instead improving the external validity. So essentially trying the programs out in the community first with real world community partners rather than in tightly controlled, you know, sort of clinical or I shouldn't say clinical, but more research setting with you know, a lot of highly internal valid, so a lot of inclusion criteria required. So sort of loosening those inclusion criteria, bringing many a vast variety of participants into the study to really truly understand how the interventions work in real world settings. Second, and I do want to get back to talking about older adults, since that's my area of expertise, I guess I should definitely put my two cents in that arena. But with regards to reach, you know, we do have a lot of issues around reaching older adults. Again, I understand this is a workplace forum. However, you know, there does come a time in later life when there's a definite tendency for older adults to become disconnected and, you know, less, essentially less social and more homebound. And that I think that we have real challenges with finding those individuals who may be, in fact, the individuals that are at higher risk for injury falls and or have more comorbidity. So I think what we can use, which is the third thing I wanted to mention, is technology as a way to find people and you know, enrich them, but also to deliver interventions, in particular to adults, older and middle-aged, who happen to be less social and or more homebound. So, you know, the intervention that I talked about can absolutely be delivered using tablets, computers, and I think that as the baby boomer generation ages, what we'll find is that there will be, you know, the technological literacy rate will continue to increase, so that it will be much easier to get these sorts of interventions out into the community.
Thank you. And Dr. Fisher?
Yeah, I mean, I don't do research, but certainly looking at the research that I'm thinking about tertiary prevention. So when I was preparing for this talk, just doing, you know, searches for literature as far as tertiary prevention goes, I couldn't find any. I mean, and I think it comes down to sort of on the clinical provider to decide, you know, what their treatment algorithm is going to be in a case like this. And even with, you know, looking at the NIOSH and the OSHA websites and trying to see what available data they have, as far as considerations for serious falls, I just couldn't find it. So if somebody knows there's something out there, let me know. But I think that's where the data needs to be collected. So if there is a fall, what are considerations for clinicians to have? You know, what other players should be involved in care for that patient? I feel like I was lucky in the state of Oregon to be able to get the care that I got for this particular patient, but also for other patients. And I think one of the reasons is because the onus is on the physician, the chiropractor, whoever the attending is for that patient, the onus is on us to demonstrate that this patient needs continued care. And I think if there's better data to back up our clinical decision-making regarding the complexities of the falls, I think that that would be very helpful for the patient and, you know, hopefully help with prevention and get simply work comp organizations on board also with probably funding prevention and funding organizations, these smaller ones especially, to make sure that it would help them, you know, perhaps pay for some of these fall prevention engineering controls.
Thank you. That's very interesting. I would like to open this up to the audience for your questions. And Dr. Varma had one. Dr. Varma wanted to make one point, and then we'll start taking your questions.
I just want to give you this data point: is that the burden of injuries from falls is increasing in the U.S. It's increasing in general population. It's increasing in workplace. So you look at the fatalities are increasing. If you look at non-fatal injuries, that are increasing in workplace and also in general population. And a lot of this has to do with aging of the population. But even when we take aging into account, even then we see that there is an increasing risk of falls, an increasing fatalities from falls in the U.S. And we don't know why.
Maybe the people are texting while they're
walking. there are a lot of things. People are getting more obese. Right. The diabetes prevalence is increasing. Arthritis prevalence is increasing. We are very distracted now. But that just points to, like, we need to redouble our effort.
I have one more point. People become a habit.
So we need to redouble our efforts to reduce falls in general population and in the workplace.
Excellent. Okay, here.
Well, you covered part of my question. If each of you would consider the role of obesity, we know that this is across our population, and is there any comment that you have on, is there a relationship, you know, per pound, does it relate to increased likelihood of fall or severity of fall, or do you have any comment in particular on obesity?
I can start just by saying, as far as patients that I've seen, and this is just, I would say purely anecdotal, I didn't collect data about this, but in my, just thinking about the patients that I had and have had that are obese, their time to heal is so much slower. Because they're already physically deconditioned, and so to reconditioning an ankle or a shoulder, it just takes so much longer when they didn't have that strength and mobility to start with. So it definitely plays a role.
I'd just like to say absolutely, and from my perspective, it does tie back into the comorbidities that are more prevalent with obesity. For instance, diabetes, type 2 diabetes. We know that type 2 diabetes does have a negative impact on cognitive functioning, and then that is a downward spiral into having and being at higher risk for balance problems, balance impairments, and/or falls. So other vascular conditions where that could affect cognitive functioning. So I'm speaking with that hat on, just thinking about all of these other comorbidities and how they influence cognition, which we know that influences balance.
I have a study using the longitudinal survey data. So among all the contributors to work-related injury, not only fall injuries, but overall work-related injuries, obesity is one of the major factors.
Obesity has shown it changes your balance. So you are at increased risk of fall. You said obesity leads to diabetes. Diabetes leads to peripheral neuropathy, and then again it leads to, so the cognitive function is one pathway. Peripheral neuropathy is another pathway. Diabetes also leads to arthritis, and arthritis is shown to increase the risk of falls. It's looking at some, I think by 2030, 35% of U.S. adults will have arthritis. The obesity leads to so many different ailments that lead to fall.
Yes.
And let's not forget polypharmacy or just drugs in general, many have reactions, side effects that support them. So I have a question which anyone can address. I think it came up, Dr. Varma, in your presentation the most. It was the perplexing thing for me. Your curve was such that the Middle Ages were more risking fall than the older adults. That was a percentage thing, and there wasn't a number thing, I believe. So why do you suppose that is?
So the question, why the increased incidence in the younger age group?
Well, the middle age
group.
The highest.
Yeah. But that was not percentage, right? That was the total incidence.
No, that was percentage.
That was the number. So that was the point I was trying to make. Is even though the risk goes up pretty smoothly, actually you can say exponentially as you age, because there are so many people, if you look at absolute number of fall or people who have fall injuries, there are a lot of people are in the middle age age group and young age group. So
the absolute number, I understand.
And actually there's something that we see that happens it goes pretty down at 65 to 74 and then kind of goes back up, and you know, we don't know why that is. It may be that as people are retiring, they are not, so they don't have that much risk of like work-related falls. They're not going out that much, and they're still maintaining their physiology better, so it has not gone down that much. So that may be, but we don't know why that kind of goes down, and then in 75 plus, it goes back up.
That's interesting.
I think it may also be behavioral adaptation, you know, I mean, particularly with fear falling. And that graph caught my attention too. I jotted that down, so I'm glad that you asked that question. That, it seemed to me that there's a spike, and I wonder how much fear of falling plays into that, where, you know, they've had the fall, perhaps an injury, and, you know, now a modified behavior to hopefully prevent future falls.
Yeah, I want to address our following basic topic. Several of us mentioned that the aging population and the baby boomers. So looking at this, the distribution, that's not the proportion, not the rate, right? Why that is so big? Because that is the bigger number in that the age of the population. So who are they? They're baby boomers. Because the baby boomer is the biggest cohort in the general population. So that's why, and they have the largest, occupied the largest portion of the entire population. On the other hand, this cohort, now it's still very active in workplace. They have more exposure in terms of fall hazards. So for they are retired, and then they have less exposure. And then when they become even older, I know this data, but I never do the analysis from that perspective. When they are getting older, like the balance maybe becomes even worse, and then the fall injuries increase. Mm-hmm. So that's my understanding of the data.
Very quickly.
Yeah. I think also we need to take into account that the cognitive function tends to decrease every decade by about doubles the incidence of it.
Right.
So that's why the curve is
right.
So sharp.
Totally important.
Yeah.
Totally important.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Right here, Dr. Killinger.
I just wanted to follow up with a comment. I appreciate the discussion about people my age who are the most the largest group of fallers. And I certainly can relate to this is the age that we get to bifocals, and it takes about 10 years to get used to not looking through the bifocal and climbing up and down the stairs, which is the worst possible design imaginable. And secondly, we age stupidly because we think we're 25. Mm-hmm. So we're still playing softball, we're still out there trying to do all the things. When you're 70, you've developed a little bit of humility if you're smart and not do stupid things too much.
But I was also thinking that as it declines, those people are staying off the roof. They made the decision, I'm not going to get up there anymore. But any comments? Go ahead.
The other factor, you may not know that, the baby boomers, on average, this cohort is heavier than the previous cohort. Much heavier. They are about 60% of the baby boomers. So it's much larger than the previous population.
Right here.
Just a comment and then a question. I saw data recently. I think the CDC said the average woman today weighs what the average man in the U.S. weighed in the 1960s. Just the way our weight is. But one of the first graphs you showed was construction falls and construction fatalities, and it seemed to be particularly disproportionately high prior to the economic collapse of 2009.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And I'm wondering, some of that spike is accounted for, like, why buy new companies that get into construction, new novices that enter the field because it's booming and it's paying well. You have so many people in it that maybe don't have the same experience.
Exactly. So I think that the data shows the economic cycle will be fatality overall, not only the whole industry increase with the economy is booming and with the U.S. labor market and the health market was strong. And then declined during the economic recession. And now, since 2011, the injury increased along with the recovery of the economy. And so as you said, during that recession, many construction workers left this industry. Now, probably you have read some papers on the labor shortage in the construction industry. In this situation, more young workers or inexperienced workers enter this industry. And before they receive the proper training, even I provided some slideshow of the apprenticeships that receive the training at the very beginning when they enter this industry, but maybe that's not for every new workers. So they need the more training and to protect workers, not only the prevent fall injuries, but overall injuries. Training is very important. And I'd like to add some information I got from the FACE report. For those who, the young workers, the many died. About 30% are just not the FACE report, not of all the injuries. About one third of the fall decedents died in the first 6 months when they started their work.
Okay. That's a question right there.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask Rene about the cognitive training part. Is it possible that because these people have a mini mental of 24 and above, is it possible that part of this success in the cognitive training part is due to the fact that these people might be depressed and depression is associated with the force? Is that a possible explanation for your great success?
Yeah, that's a really excellent question and keen observation. Absolutely. That's something that we have analyzed is depression, and we did collect that data. And actually, there are other studies as well that show that just thinking about cognitive training and depression, that cognitive training has been shown to significantly improve depressive symptoms. So with regard to that sort of, triangular relationship between these three behaviors, I think that's a really terrific question and would be fascinating to look at. I have not looked at my data that way, but I have found that with the third study that I briefed over so quickly, the one involving the cognitively impaired individuals, that we did see a significant improvement in depressive symptoms following that cognitive training intervention. So, I think I'll go home and look at that.
Dr. Haas?
The data that was presented shows that women have a higher risk of fall than men. And I'd be interested to hear your opinions on the reason for that, because there are probably conflicting factors here. Older women will have more osteoporosis, but then they probably have less risky behavior. So how's the balance out in favor of men? The first thing I've ever seen in favor of men.
There are a lot of factors that are going on in there. One is, yes, the osteoporosis. After menopause, they also have decreased muscle strength. So that may also contribute to their recovery from falls. That may be showing that there's a divergent trend between males and females. Anatomy, the pelvic anatomy could be another reason. When we have done field studies among workers, and we focus on same level falls as compared to lower level falls, and we asked workers, young workers, about their slips and trips, and we constantly hear from young women workers is that I trip on myself. And we don't really know whether it is a reporting thing, is that they are more likely to report that they trip on themselves, or is it that they are actually at a higher risk of tripping. Then the footwear would be the other issue. They change. They have multiple footwear in on an average than men do. So there are multiple things that are going on why women could have higher risk of falls as compared to men. Some we know, we don't.
I just had a question. I don't know if this has been looked at, but I'm also wondering if, just looking at physical conditioning again, if a male, this has been, I know in your studies you actually ask them have you fall or not, but when you're looking at reporting incident as a way to gather data, if a male falls, maybe it's that even if it's an older male, has the strength and the ability to get back up off the ground, it's an event that, goes on with his life, it's never reported, doesn't seek care, whereas if a woman has falls and has decreased strength and conditioning and osteoporosis, maybe more likely to get a fracture, then of course those are going to be reported and remembered and I'm just wondering how much that affects the data also, just, conditioning and older,
The muscle strength and bone strength and all those things, they affect the conditioning. Actually, if you look at the NHIS data, older men, their fall experience looks like a middle-aged women, so from 45 to 64. So that's,
I think that's a very good point. If you want to know what makes the difference, it's better to do some multiple variable analysis, say that all the factors like the weight, like the activities, that I think that those variables are available in the data source, you can compare how the other factors are different or not between men and women.
Also, if you could refresh my memory, the incidence was higher in all age groups. Is that true?
Yeah.
So that would almost subtract out the osteoporosis a little bit, right?
But if you look at the fall injury rates, it kind of starts out a little bit higher, but then it gets higher, like the difference gets bigger and bigger.
So it might account for that.
Yeah.
That difference.
So,
okay.
So that's what I was saying, that slope looks steeper. We haven't statistically tested whether it is actually statistically significantly different.
As I said, my clinical experience, though, is that, especially in the clinic, if I'm looking at a man and a woman the same age, instead they're each 60, I'm almost astounded at the inability of sometimes a 50 or 60-year-old woman to get herself up off the floor. And so that's concerning, and so that's why I'm wondering also, as they get older, they're becoming more deconditioned, which has a lot to do with the obesity aspect.
I have a question. I just wonder, in terms of the balance of the women,
I mean, that is my personal experience. I tend to see not as good a balance in my female patients, again, when they're getting postmenopausal.
We have time for one or two more questions. Yes.
Just to add to that conversation that about a third of men over 70 get no measurable physical activity, but about half of women over 70 get no measurable physical activity. And falls are a function of not moving. So if you're not moving, and it is half the population, you can always have that higher level. And I would say that the disparity between physical activity does span over many of the age categories that you put up there on the chart.
Okay, we'll end with Dr. Hanline.
I just wanted to comment on Dr. Fisher's presentation. I'm the two of the prime examples of integrative culture and the approach I'm going to talk about the patient. And that also points to the benefit of having collaborative sessions here at PhD.
I think that's a good note to end on. There are just a couple items here. First, let's thank all of our presenters. I think this was an outstanding session. I mean, you all did a great job. You really did. It was just terrific. Those of you getting continuing education credits, please see Claire Johnson. Please evaluate this session on the mobile app. All right. And I'd like to again thank all of the presenters and thank you in the audience for some very insightful questions. And this session is now closed. Thank you very much.